This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Historian W. Andrew Achenbaum has observed, older people are seldom seen as agents of cultural change. But as we are growing older, he thinks we should think anew about aging. He says the extension of the human life course will affect virtually all elements of our nation's mosaic. Consider this. There are more than twice as many Americans over 65 today as in 1960. The number of centenarians has more than doubled in the U.S. since 1980. In the very early days of our republic, the median age was 16. By 1994, it was 34. Those factoids come from Andy Achenbaum's book, Older Americans, Vital Communities, A Bold Vision for Societal Aging. In this portion of the program, we'll talk with him about the possibilities and the challenges he sees for a maturing America. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Andy Achenbaum is a professor of history and social work at the University of Houston. He is a well-known leader in the field of gerontology and serves as the chair of the board of directors of the National Council on Aging. His book, Older Americans, Vital Communities, A Bold Vision for Societal Aging, is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Andy, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Celeste, for inviting me.
My pleasure. Well, what do you envision for your life in your later years?
That's a good question, especially since I'm 60. And so obviously give a lot of thought to it.
Yeah.
I'm keenly aware of the fact that I'm going to die. And I'm keenly aware, without making this sound too morbid, that I probably have fewer sunrises ahead of me than I've had behind me. And so it's time to get really serious about what really matters to me. And what really matters to me are my children, leaving them with the rest of the boomers a legacy which at the moment doesn't look too good, and doing things that I just really want to do and scrapping the rest. I have a girlfriend I like very, very much. Discovering what late life love is all about has been challenging. Interesting. And I think keeping optimistic and energetic as a teacher. I've been a teacher most of my life. Most of what I've taught has been erroneous. So I have time to make up for some fallacies.
Huh. That sounds good.
Thank you.
What led you to your interest in aging?
I'm sorry?
What led you to your interest in aging?
My father, who expected his oldest son to be a doctor or a lawyer, and when he announced he was going to be a professor, looked slightly aghast. And when he went on to say he wanted to be a professor of history, said, "We'll do something that's sort of forward-looking." And I said, "Well, gee, Dad, I don't really think there's much forward-looking about history." And he said, "Well, find something." And for a set of circumstances, which I think would bore even you and your readers and listeners, I seized on aging, and I went back to him and I said, "I have it. I'm going to write the history of aging." And he looked even more despondent than he looked when I told him my professional goals and said, "What do you know about aging?" I said, "What do I know about anything? You go into great libraries like the University of Illinois, and you look at their archives, and you look at their books, and after 3 or 4 years, when your money runs out, you write a dissertation that says, on the one hand, on the other hand, and hope for the best." So that's what I did. My life was transformed because I was going to stop the book where I thought historians stopped and allowed political scientist to take over, with Ida Fuller getting a Social Security check in 1940. And a book publisher, of all things, said, you know, you'd make more money if you brought this book up to the present. And I looked at him and I said, historians don't make money. And he said, well, that's noble. Aren't you curious as to what happened after 1940? And that question ruined my life, because I have spent the rest of my life essentially looking about the contours of the meanings and experiences of aging, largely in the 20th century, even though I was trained to be a colonial and 19th century historian.
As a nation, other than our concerns for the health and well-being of older Americans, have we thought much about what it will mean when half the population will be approaching 40?
No. And that's, you know, because it's not immediate. It's not Katrina, which galvanizes us to think about race and class and the environment. It's not like even a good Medicare scare. It's something that's just sort of happening. We put it on the back burner, in part because we're afraid of it. I think ageism is going to be something that my children and grandchildren, if I have them, are going to have to spend a lot of time worrying about, and which I find even affects my life a little bit.
So this is something that's sneaking up on us.
It is, but it shouldn't be, because there have been demographers and eminent people at the University of Illinois and other Big Ten schools and around the nation who have been predicting a nation of elders in the making for 60 years. But people just don't take it very, very seriously. It's not dramatic. It's not gripping until it begins to hit you. And even when it hits you, you can deny it. You know, that happened to Mom. It's not going to happen to me. And heck, I mean, 60 for me is not 30 like AARP says, but it's certainly a lot better physically and mentally than I expected it to be. So why not postpone it?
Yeah. You mentioned ageism. How significant an issue is ageism today, and how do you see it in the near future and maybe a little farther out?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, you're not going to like the answer. Ageism in some ways is like racism, which is just inappropriate, sexism, which is just inappropriate, despite some of the reverberations we've been seeing in the political campaign. I can't make a homophobic remark. I really shouldn't make an anti-Semitic or anti-Catholic or anti-Episcopalian remark. But I can make an ageist joke anytime I want. And institutions seem to marginalize people once they get to be a certain age. And so the question is, how do you get people to think about aging as being something other than what happens to you when you're senile or over the age of 70? And I think the answer is that just as we bring sex education, human relations into elementary and secondary school curriculum, it would be well to remind sixth graders that their grandparents aren't the only ones who are growing old. And that lifelong education, most of us have a pretty bumpy ride and several rodeos between the age of sixth grade and 60. Teaching people how to cope with change and challenges and to predict it makes late life challenges and opportunities, I think, much more doable.
This is something that you mentioned briefly in the book, Older Americans, Vital Communities, and that's the issue of language. And I really agree with you here, but I don't know how do we put seniors and senior citizens, those two terms, how do we put them away?
Well, we either put them away or we give them a more positive spin. When I told you that I wanted to leave a legacy, I certainly am not going to leave my children millions of dollars. I'm not even going to leave them an internationally renowned reputation. If I can teach my kids that every individual deserves dignity and respect precisely because he or she lives, that would be a great legacy. But it's too easy to see gray hairs and sort of mock it. But they can change. Last night, I actually went to my first aerobics class ever. I was the only male in the room, and I think I had 25 to 30 years on virtually everyone else. It was an hour. It was awful. It was just awful. I had no idea that you were going to perspire so much. I had no idea that you had to keep up at this fast pace. And some sweet young woman came up to me and said, I think it's sweet that you're here. I was glad that she didn't have to call the cardiac unit. I was really pleased. And I think she was pleased I was there. And of course I was horrible. I was got to be the worst person in the room. But I didn't care. I was having fun. I was getting some exercise. Mm-hmm. I weighed 2 pounds less this morning. It was great.
Yeah, yeah. That's one of the sweet things that comes with age, isn't it? There's a relaxation about the outside packaging.
There really is. And I think there's more looking inward, not only at yourself, but at others. But it's tough. It's tough in a world that puts a premium on 14-year-olds being our model of ideal femininity or masculinity. Most of us just don't look like we're 14. And so we have to adjust our image of ourselves accordingly, which is not to say I think we should be obese. So obesity is a major U.S. health problem, not confined to older people. Unfortunately, it's confined sometimes to sixth graders, too. But I think staying fit, viewing your body as a machine that can wear out, but that you can prevent certain things happening if you don't do stupid things with it, realizing that you can actually abuse your body more than you might have thought you could, as long as you don't do it too often, allows you a certain license for Mardi Gras when you're doing your fundraiser.
When you look out across the media landscape, what do you see in terms of images of aging?
Well, I still see Walter Cronkite occasionally, right?
Mm-hmm.
I still see Barbara Walters occasionally. If I look in the Senate and the House of Representatives, I see a few gray hairs. In churches and synagogues, I see gray beards. But I don't see very much in the media. Market that apparently they are shooting for is 25 to 39, even though I suspect I have as much money, if not more, than a lot of them at my disposal. But marketers don't really know how to reach me because I'm such an idiosyncratic group. Your assistant asked me to make sure no call waiting came on this phone. I said, I can do that. And then she tried to explain to me how to do it, and by the time she got done trying to explain it to me, I said, let's just hope no calls come in for the next half hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I've got friends who have Blackberries and iPods. Someone tried to sign me on to YouTube, which sounded to me like something wrapped up in cellophane. You know, that's just not my interest.
Yeah, yeah.
On the other hand, someone suggests a good book for me to read. I leap at the chance. If someone interests me and they say, boy, this excites me, I look for excitement. Where do people take pleasure? Where do they get their passion? And usually their passion and enthusiasm is not far-fetched. So the capacity to learn, I'm cutting back. Just do reading that I want to do.
Hmm.
I still show up for classes. I'd like to be paid. I'm not convinced there's going to be enough health care for all of us. Some presidents keep wanting to cut back on Medicare.
Yeah. When do you hope to retire?
I don't.
Oh.
I don't. I mean, I'm a university professor, so the link between work and retirement is hard for any state legislature to figure out.
Mm.
And so until they fire me or I do something really disreputable, I expect to keep on working. I love being around people who are younger than I and older than I, and I love ideas for their own sake, and I love to lecture, obviously, and so I see no point.
Mm.
If I see myself diminishing in capacity, physically or mentally, psychologically, I would hope I would have the good grace to step aside before someone ordered me to.
Yeah. Over the last couple of years here at the radio station at WILL, we've seen a number of coworkers retire. And they are not old. I would describe them as being in maybe late middle age. Is that unusual, or is this something that we're seeing more of?
No, I think we are seeing a lot of it, but you know, like every generalization about old age, I should sit here like a lawyer and give you 19 different exceptions. I mean, I assume these people felt that they had the financial wherewithal to be comfortable for the next 30 or 40 years pursuing meaningful things. Certainly, the average age of retirement for men and women is below the official retirement age, which for me now is 66, not 65, and going up, but only going up a little bit. So there are some people. You know, my brother's a wealthy man. I don't think he has to work, but he likes to work. But if I were a blue-collar worker who had been doing the same job, or if I were not getting health benefits or many other benefits from my part-time work, I would view jobs slightly differently than the really privileged position I find myself in.
Hmm. Do you think, though, as the country's population ages, as we're all getting older, we'll need people to remain in the workforce for a longer period of time?
I think we are, but I think if we're going to do that, we're going to have to repot people. And the best way to do that is probably through the continuing education services of the University of Illinois and comparable institutions. The fact that I don't know how to stop call waiting is funny on one level, but it shows a certain technological deficiency. And if there was a course that would teach me how to use my computer and convince me I wasn't going to get some social disease, or if there was really somebody who could aid me in learning how to use call waiting, not to mention other things that I'm sure I'm paying for that I don't know how to use on my phone, I'd be a lot better off. I think a major demand on universities is going to be to get past their lockstop vision of undergraduates by and large being at a certain age, followed by graduate and professional schools students being mostly under the age of 40. A school like the University of Houston, which is a commuter urban public school, we get an extraordinary mixture of people from different income levels and racial backgrounds. We get a lot of divorced women who have to go back in the labor force and really aren't prepared to do so. And so I've really had a chance working in the College of Social Work to deal with some of the needs and fears of especially women over the age of 40 as they try to write me an essay and are terrified of writing. And so I spend as much time confidence building as I do, I think, actually critiquing their work.
Mm-hmm. You use the word repot or repotting. What do you mean?
What I mean is, suppose I really couldn't stand the thought of facing another semester. The thought of another blue book to grade. Another lecture on Reconstruction, which I've memorized to death, boring even me. Then I think it's time for me to say this has been great and go do something else. And I'd probably do something else like go work for some social service agency. Maybe not even for the elderly. I'm really quite interested in people with chronic diseases and people who are getting ready for hospice of any age. And so I'd need some training, and I'd get it. I'd work in a hospital setting. And I was actually toyed with it. In fact, before this phone call, I talked about somebody about getting that sort of training and preparation ready. And I see no reason why I shouldn't phase down some of my teaching career and get into something where I'm actually dealing with people still in a inner face-to-face situation, but a very, very different setting where I would listen, really listen to their stories and their fears instead of me pontificating about John Quincy Adams.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is a historian. His name is W. Andrew Achenbaum, and he is the author of Older Americans, Vital Communities, A Bold Vision for Societal Aging. Andy Achenbaum is a professor of history and social work at the University of Houston. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with a question, a comment. We'd love to hear from you. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. That's 333-9455. WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, one of the benefits for some workers of remaining in the workforce, this is another one of these tricky questions when maybe you could step into your lawyer's shoes again, but employer-paid health insurance and health care is such a huge issue. To what extent might this affect how long workers remain on the job? And given, and then the bigger picture is, or the bigger question is, given the demographic picture, the big picture, will we be forced to confront the issue of how to pay for health care in the not-too-distant future, not only for older Americans, but for all Americans?
That's a great question, and I don't actually have to give you a legal answer, but I am going to give you a very partisan answer. The partisan answer is, I think access to health care should be a womb-to-tomb right of being an American citizen. And so I would advocate covering those 47 million Americans who have no access to health care at all. It bothers me sometimes to whip out my Blue Cross Blue Shield card in one of the great medical centers of the world and realize that I'm being seen by super specialists for something that I suspect an internist could take care of just as easily. And yet there are people who are flocking into the emergency room because it's the only place they can go. What I've just proposed is going to be more expensive because I'm obviously going to be covering people who aren't necessarily the most fit, the most affluent care people. And you're right about the older population costing more. We are going to have more chronic illnesses we want to attend to, and we're going to die sooner or later. In fact, we spend 40% of all Medicare dollars on the last 6 months of life. The trouble is none of us is God, and so we don't really know when the last 6 months of life is going to be for a lot of people. And so we have several choices. One, I think, is that I don't have a right to having Dr. DeBakey look at my heart. I don't even need Dr. DeBakey to look at my heart. Most of the ailments I have, and I'm a cancer, I had cancer, and I have a couple of chronic illnesses, but most of my ailments are sort of nickel and dime stuff. And so giving me care by a good nurse practitioner who's been well-trained would probably suffice in 80% of the cases. So I've got to decide that I don't deserve a Cadillac. On the other hand, there's been talk, as you know, of the federal government allowing people to cut off access to health care benefits to people over the age of 65 in order to treat those who are without benefits under the age of 45. That's sort of a draconian choice as far as I'm concerned. I certainly think that 45-year-old people, especially people with young children, need to have access to health care. But I don't think there's any magical age in which someone who happens to be older doesn't need health care.
Is there adequate training in medical schools for caring for elderly patients?
Well, you really read that book carefully. no. I spend part of my time helping a geriatrics unit get started at the University of Texas Health Center. And it's amazing the number of geriatric fellowships which go wanting in not only in medical schools, but nursing schools, schools of public health, and social work, because young people just can't identify or see themselves working with older people. The number of courses given to late-life problems is minimal. A lot of it is just not that fascinating compared to the genome process. There's rarely a magic bullet that will take care of an older person. If I had to give my medical history, I could use up the rest of your airtime for the day, whereas an 18-year-old would probably be 2 minutes.
Mm.
If I want to do a good geriatric workup, it's going to take an hour. Most Medicare reimburses for 7 to 8 minutes. Do I sacrifice what? And to what end? So no, the answer is no. And in fact, I think ageism, to go back to that word, is as virulent in the medical industrial complex as in any sector of our society. When they talk about Gomers, get them out of my emergency room, or Crocs, they're not recognizing the fact that this is a sentient human being who is once himself, herself, their age, who needs help.
What's a Croc?
A Croc? It's an old Croc. It's someone who's got to be recycled out of my area.
Well, that chapter was very interesting. It's very sobering, and maybe that's one of the reasons too. We would rather just as soon not look at what's up ahead on the road for us as we get older.
And that's true. But as I said, I mean, I took an aerobics class last night. After this is over, I'm going to go swimming. I took a walk this morning with a daughter. You know, I mean, am I going to win a gold medal? I doubt it. For nothing. I'm a terrible athlete. In fact, it's been very, very liberating. I used to be picked to be third base, not to play third base. And now everyone assumes that I'm incompetent, out of shape, blah, 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 blah. So I'm quite free to just jostle along at my own merry pace. And whatever I do, walking stairs instead of taking the elevator, just is enough cardiovascularly to keep me in reasonably good shape. Not smoking or stopping to smoke, even at the age of 60, would clear up my lungs in about 6 years, so you would almost not know I had a prior history. When your body is that capable of being pliable, it's really, I think, wrong. And it's a tremendous social cost to the rest of us to have people abuse their body. It goes the other way. When I was sick, it was really nice to have somebody touch me. Well, obviously, if they had touched me in an inappropriate way, there'd be all sorts of lawsuits. But a simple touch, a simple recognition, someone who would actually ask me what I preferred to be called. When my mother called me Andrew, I was in trouble, so I hate the name Andrew. I always use Andy. I mean, I'll be 80 and I'll still be Andy, even though it's a little, you know, out of shape. Older people respond to that. I'll go into a room and visit somebody, and I'll say, well, what's up? And I'm amazed at what they'll tell me. I've been with Alzheimer's patients and have sung some hymn, Episcopal hymnal, and they remember it, and they come alive again. It's not quite like Oliver Sacks, but there's some really wonderful moments with older people. I snuck a kitten in once to a hospital. The woman remembered her kitten and petted it. There are just some wonderful, I think, just wonderfully exciting things that can be done. And as you yourself get a little bit older, you begin to empathize a little bit more with some of these foibles.
Well, one of the things that makes you do is you have to slow down. You have to be with that person.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, we're so driven by the time and getting things done that just being and being in the present is, if not uncomfortable, it's unfamiliar. But it's really one of the great advantages of late life.
There's a chapter in the book about growing older and spirituality.
Right.
That's very interesting, and I want to quote someone who you quote in the book, who's an ecologist, Thomas Berry. He says, the choice before us as we are older people is participate either as a positive contributor or as a negative burden to the community and to the earth. And here we get into the role of not only being somehow spiritually connected, whether that's with a faith per se or some other kind of connection, but that also gets us then to citizenship as well. So you want to talk about that, take that ball and run with it?
Sure. I think one of the gifts that boomers may give us as a culture is a greater appreciation for spirituality. I don't buy the argument that if I'm religious, I'm not spiritual, or if I'm spiritual, I'm not religious.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there are different dimensions. When I go to a house of worship over the weekend, I subscribe to the creed and the institution. But my spiritual life is something that I sort of conduct every moment of my life, because I think within, getting in touch with the spark within, and I think of a much larger world. And Mr. Burry's comment about the environment is absolutely right. And I think my awareness of the effect of global warming, my awareness of the importance of water, have a spiritual dimension. But they rise me out of my lethargy to really want to work on that. I mean, what can older people do about the environment? I'm an older person. What can I do? What can I write? What can I say? What can I pass on to my children? Because if I don't do something, my children or their children are going to live in a much more horrible world. And I say that as a patriotic, if not nationalistic, American, who also realizes that I'm a citizen of the world and that I'm intimately connected with some of the natural disasters that have occurred not only in this country, but elsewhere, all of which affect the quality of life. And so, yes, I think there's a great connection between my private spirituality, my concerns for the environment, which are fairly late in life in realizing, and also late in life, my sense that while I'm a U.S. citizen, I'm really a member of a world community. So constantly sort of adjust myself, in part with the Internet, believe it or not, between the global and the local. Houston's not exactly the most healthy environment to live in, with all the oil derricks and all the pollution from a major metropolis. When I lived in Ann Arbor, we used to worry about PCBs in the stream. I was in Buffalo during Love Canal. I sometimes feel like Typhoid Andy.
When we look out across the globe, what can we learn from the experience of how other people are facing these issues?
Well, I think it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, take some place like Japan, where after World War II, life expectancy was very, very low, in part because of the war. And now that's the longest-lived population in the world. There was a time in which venerating elders was a strict cultural and religious norm in Japan. There's limited land. There's limited real estate. Space is tight. And so that traditional filial responsibility has been challenged at the same time, in which I suspect there is more deference paid to elders in Japan than there are here. And I think the story varies from place to place. I mean, I think we have much to learn from what's going on in Western Europe as they redesign some of their welfare plans to accommodate an aging population. Surely the Japanese, the Germans, the French, the Brits have spent far more time worrying about the significance of societal aging, you know, which you were talking about earlier, about the average age of the population going from 13 to 34 mm-hmm. to nearly 40. That's really an issue. And I think Mr. Burry is right. I could be dead, part of a cohort. The boomers could be part of a cohort that's dead weight. I'm banking and betting that the activists among us from the late 60s will rediscover our political voice. But I'm also mindful, and I hope it's not too partisan to say this, that Mr. Obama's thesis may be right. Maybe the boomer generation should step aside. Having given the world at least one Clinton and two Bushes, and allow another generation, which is not still fighting the war in Vietnam, which really doesn't remember the civil rights movement or the feminist movement the way I do, and let another generation take over. But even if we do that, I think we have a moral, ethical, political, and social responsibility to contribute to the common weal. We just cannot drain precious resources for our own satisfaction.
Mm.
How's that for moralistic?
Well, what are some of the things that the Europeans are doing that we might take a look at and say, well, that's an interesting approach?
Well, I think I'd look at things like transportation, just to start off.
Mm-hmm.
To travel around in Europe is really fairly cheap and fairly efficient. If you're not buying gasoline at $8 a gallon, which is probably what our gas should cost, too. Public transportation is wonderful. Public transportation in this country is horrible. In a town like Houston, it's almost risible, although there is a trolley line that I can now take down to the medical center when I have to go, and that's a great help. Housing. We assume people are going to live alone. Most older people, in fact, do live alone. Whereas in Europe, because of some of the space crunch and so forth, the notion of communal housing, intergenerational housing, works tremendously. My daughter lived with me for 6 months. We have different lifestyles, different tastes, different interests. But it was really great. You know, she made some interesting food. Some of my food was edible. We shared chores. I think that's something we can learn from. Politically, we have an odd form of political democracy, which we're probably not going to change. But I think that what we're going to need in this election campaign is to talk about the future of Medicare. I think we wasted a lot of political energy talking about the privatization of Social Security. I think Social Security is a great system. It's not going to go bankrupt. The worst it's going to do is cost us another percent of our payroll tax, which, given the way prices are going up, is pretty trivial. And it'll be good till 2080, which means long past the baby boom generation's lifetime and the baby generation's children. But Medicare, Medicare is just a time bomb.
Yeah, well, so is Medicaid.
And Medicaid. I combine the two of them into some national health insurance program. I mean, the trouble with Medicaid is that a lot of the long-term care options that we have for older people are in Medicaid, and they carry with them fairly stringent income rules, which I would never meet. On the other hand, Medicare and some of its various parts certainly have helped, on average, most people's pharmacy bills, but they still have a long way to go. As long as we view Medicare as taking care of acute ailments, lung cancer, heart disease, diabetes, we're okay. But what about those of us who suffer from arthritis? What about those of us who suffer from some mental disorder? And I'm not even talking about something like schizophrenia or something. We're really in trouble. And so we're going to really have to rethink and unpack our medical programs to look at a population, I'd say over the age of 40, because that's when chronic ailments become more apparent and acute ailments become more vicious.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous challenge.
Yeah, yeah. That's something that's very difficult to address, it seems to me, politically. That's such a tough...
Well, unfortunately, here's where the historian's track comes in. In 1916, I think we were really ready to have national health coverage. But by the end of World War I, with our antipathy towards towards Germans, the word socialist crept into the vocabulary. And so whenever anyone mentions something about universal health care, the thought of infringing on doctors' autonomy, as if insurance companies don't do so already, gets raised as this huge specter. My sense is that what we would probably end up with optimally is people like me who don't have much money being covered by the government in some program. We'd probably have to wait a little longer to see a physician, as is true in other countries. And those who, like my brother, who can afford the best medical care in the world, God bless them. Long live democracy and God bless capitalism.
I'm intrigued by what you said a little earlier about living alone, because I think that we know, we intuit that to be with others really improves one's quality of life. And yet so many people live alone, especially the elderly. I think it would be very interesting to look at how we might set up some really creative living arrangements.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I live alone, but I usually am in human contact face-to-face
right.
two or three times a day. And so I'm not lonely.
Yeah. Well,
And the other thing is I'm comfortable with myself. And I think that's an advantage of old age, which most undergraduates I teach don't feel. They're insecure about whether or not they're going to get into Harvard Law, whether or not they're going to get dumped by their girlfriend. There are several other things they're concerned about, but I suspect that's not suitable for your listening audience. You know, I just don't have those anxieties and fears. But it's very nice, as I said, to take a walk with your daughter for 2 miles in the morning.
Yeah. And I'm not even thinking of, you know, roommates or something like
right.
that. I think that living alone has its joys, but at the same time, what I'm thinking about is maintaining those connections outside your apartment.
That's
or
right.
Your house.
And the question becomes, you know, and part of it is the death of a spouse, the divorce from a spouse in late life. You do lose friends. People pick sides. Or I become handicapped in a way which makes me immobile. How do I maintain those connections? And I think what we have relied on very often is religious institutions to provide that network or social groups of some sort or another. But if I were pointing an ageist finger, I would point at religious institutions too. Most mainstream Protestant churches I've ever looked at are much more concerned about luring in the 30-year-old couple with their young children, figuring that's going to give them growth in the future, than they are maintaining the concern and even the contributions that are made by people who've served on the vestry and are now phasing down.
Yeah. So, some time ago, not all that long ago, I was talking with a friend of mine, and we were talking about, she was facing a move, she and her family, and we were talking about what makes a desirable neighborhood, and both of us, I think, came to the conclusion that a desirable community is a community where you have on your block people of all walks of life and different stages of life.
I think you two were very perceptive. Houston happens to be a town that doesn't believe in zoning, so you can imagine what my block looks like. I have, you know, mansions, and I have crack houses on the same two blocks of my street. And while I'm not real happy about the crack house,
right.
It lends a certain color. I don't walk at night. But it's great, and you're right, they're different age groups. And what's interesting to me is to realize that, you know, I'm now joining the upper end of the scale of the age groups. And so when people call me sir, it's not just Southern habit. It's really deference to my balding pate. And
yeah.
I go, well, I guess I am.
Yeah.
But then again, when I go to the movie and look and they say, senior citizen discount, age 60, I go, whoa, I'll show you my driver's license. Getting carded again is fun.
There we've got to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I'm very flattered to be asked. Even as a Michigan alum, it's nice to talk to somebody from Illinois.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Have a great swim.
Thank you.
Historian Andy Achenbaum has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. If you're interested in some of the things that we've been talking about in this portion of the program, you might want to look for his book, Older Americans, Vital Communities, A Bold Vision for Societal Aging. The book is published by the Johns Hopkins University Press.